begin today's session. So while I call up Bill's presentation, I'll go ahead and ask Bill to come off of mute and feel free to get started whenever he's ready.
Well, thank you, Jean. I really appreciate all that information, and I want to thank everyone for joining us on this training. This is jointly hosted by the EPA Office of Site Remediation and Enforcement. That's the Superfund Enforcement Program, or the attorneys that work with us in enforcing the Superfund law and the Superfund Redevelopment Program. My name is Bill Denman, and I am Chief of the Redevelopment and Chemicals Branch in EPA Region 4, but I'm currently on a detail or temporary assignment to EPA headquarters to work in the Superfund Redevelopment Program. I've had a long history of working on Superfund redevelopment since before the 2002 amendments, and have done this for many years and just really have a passion for helping get Superfund sites put back into productive use. There are lots of great examples, and there are lots of great examples of how local governments can play a role, a critical role, in helping get these sites put back into productive use. This is the third of these trainings that we've put on. We did this similar training first just within EPA to kind of practice and get it kind of honed in, and then we did one in December that we targeted local governments. And now this one's open to the public, so we're so glad that everyone can join us. Hopefully we have our information down now, and we're just really going to do a great job at getting this information across. So if any of you in the groups that missed the first two, glad you could join us. For those of you just in the public that are calling in, thanks for joining this. And also wanted to add that on February 4th at 1 o'clock, we will offer this training again in Spanish. So if anyone is listening that would prefer to hear this in Spanish, please tune in to us on February 4th. We'll have a translator and slides in Spanish to make it available to those folks that would prefer it in Spanish. So thank you all again for joining us, and let's get started. Okay, as I said, local governments can play an important role in getting Superfund sites back into productive use. And here's an overview of what we're going to talk about today. So I'm going to start off in talking about successful Superfund site redevelopment strategies and tools for local governments. Again, this is from the program side. And then my colleagues Matt Sander and Victor Certucci from the EPA Office of Site Remediation and Enforcement will be talking about some of the Superfund liability concerns of local governments. And that's, you know, really getting into the meaty part of the webinar. And sure, that's what a lot of you have tuned in to listen about. So that's really great information, and I learn something every time I listen, so I'm looking forward to hearing them present on it as well. And then, as Jean said, we'll have time to go over questions and answers at the end. So if you do have a question, please type it in the question box. We'll be looking at these questions as we go through the presentation, and you know, depending on the amount of time we have, we'll go through as many of them or all of them if we can, and try to get answers for you. So let's start with the Superfund site redevelopment strategies and tools for local governments and communities. The EPA Superfund Redevelopment Program supports EPA staff and works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and then integrating these options into the cleanup process. There are numerous examples of successful Superfund site reuse all over the country, and many of those examples were possible only because local governments got involved and played an active part in the reuse. It's important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. This is just a critical piece of information. There are many ways to redevelop Superfund sites, and there's no one-size-fits-all, but it's important to get these discussions going as soon as we can to determine what type of reuse would be most appropriate for the property and for the cleanup. Excuse me. The redevelopment of Superfund sites pose unique challenges in terms of protectiveness, stigma, liability protections. However, they also allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities, and we have lots of examples of different types of redevelopments, and I would encourage you, if you're interested in seeing some of these, to visit our Superfund redevelopment webpage and take a look at that. We have our success stories and a lot of fact sheets on that webpage that talk about all different kinds of uses that Superfund sites have been put back into. So it's important to realize EPA doesn't own the sites or control local land use. Of course, that's the local governments that control local land use as far as zoning and permitting and master plans and things like that. That's not EPA's. We don't have the authority or responsibility over that, and we don't own the property, but we can help return contaminated sites to a productive use, and that's important for us as part of our mission and important for the communities to be able to get these sites that they, you know, for sometimes decades have been dealing with the contamination and the issues associated with having a Superfund site in their community back into a productive use. So the good news is EPA has a wide array of tools, resources, and support for local governments, communities, and developers to use on these sites. So let's get started and talk about some of these. First of all, I wanted to talk about the big picture. So most of you are probably familiar with brownfields. You may have worked on brownfields in your communities, and it's important to know that EPA's estimate of 450,000 brownfields, and some people estimate it up as high as 600,000. All right. Thank you, Gene. Looks like my slides got a little turned off there, so we'll get back to the slide. Okay, so as we said, this is the big Jupiter in our solar system. This dwarfs all of the other types of contaminated properties because, remember, brownfields are properties that may have contamination or maybe just the perception of contamination that is holding up redevelopment. So that is a really large part of the contaminated properties that, you know, can inhibit redevelopment. It's estimated that we have 100 to 200,000 underground storage tanks, many of them also on brownfields, and we have around 40,000 Superfund sites. Now, if you're familiar with Superfund, you're like, wait a minute, I didn't think the national priorities list was that large. Well, we only have about 1,600 sites on the national priorities list, but there are about 38,000 that have been dealt with under Superfund through EPA's emergency responsible removal program. So those sites have potential circle liability, and the concepts that we're going to talk about today would apply to them as they do to NPL sites. And then there are about 6,400 RCRA corrective action sites also that are being addressed through RCRA corrective action and, you know, can have redevelopment potential. It's important also that 53%, so over half of the U.S. population, lives within 3 miles of one of these types of sites. So you can see there's a real need, a real reason to try to get these put back into productive use. So as we mentioned, helping get Superfund sites back into productive use is part of EPA's mission. We used to call this the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. We now call it the Superfund Redevelopment Program. This is part of the Superfund process, and it's part of our mission to help get these sites back to productive use. The benefits to local governments and communities include creating jobs, increasing the tax base, which is really important. It's something we don't think about a lot of times, but when a site has potential Superfund liability, you know, the taxable value is zero. But if we can increase the tax base and get sites put back into productive use, now the local government can start collecting property tax on those properties and use that for the things that local governments do. it revitalizes neighborhoods and restores a sense of community by bringing housing, retail, recreation, or ecosystem services, or a combination of those back to the community. Redevelopment also benefits EPA by bringing certainty to anticipated future land use, with a new owner who is obligated to be cooperative, provides us access, and who will be a good steward of the site. So if we have groundwater monitoring wells or a cap or something that we've done as part of our remedy, having someone on that property there every day and a good steward of the property to make sure that, you know, things don't get damaged or, you know, trash doesn't get put on the site, things like that, is really beneficial to us. Also, a new owner may be willing to settle liens, which brings money for cleanup, or take on part of the cleanup themselves, which we have the ability to negotiate agreements with them to do that, or even enhance the cleanup. We have someone now interested in one of our Superfund sites we cleaned up for commercial industrial use, but they want to use it for residential, so they want to, you know, we're working with them on how do they come in and enhance the remedy that we did now to make it a residential use instead of just a commercial industrial. George Washington University did a study that said for every acre of contaminated property that gets redeveloped, 4.5 acres of greenfields are preserved. Now, that's an environmental reason right there to try to get these sites back into productive use, and another reason that it's part of our mission. So now let's talk about a few examples. Examples of Superfund sites include government offices, shopping centers, manufacturing facilities, affordable housing, recreational fields, ecological preserves, and many, many, many more types of examples. Just a couple here. On the picture on the left is the Aberjona Nature Trail, which is part of the Industriplex Superfund site in Woburn, Massachusetts. and Wright, part of also in Woburn, is the Red Robin Gourmet Burgers and Brews, which is part of a shopping center on the Wells G&H Superfund site, as I said, also in Woburn, Massachusetts. So, you know, that's just in one area, a couple of sites and types of reuses that have occurred. Some local governments, community members, and developers think that a site's not ready for redevelopment until the cleanup is done. This is not true. If there's one thing that people get from this webinar, please know this. You don't have to wait until the site is cleaned up to think about or start working on redevelopment. In fact, the earlier EPA can identify the end use and the end user, the better. Many sites can be partially reused during the cleanup because a lot of times, you know, we don't have to access the entire site or some of the, you know, sometimes the soil parts of the site are the easiest to clean up, and we can prioritize that and get that done to allow for redevelopment while we work on some of the more complicated issues like groundwater and sediment and things like that. EPA, local governments, and developers can coordinate during cleanups to maximize the cleanup and reuse benefits. For example, maybe a parking lot is part of a plan which can be used or integrated as a cap for contamination. Maybe monitoring wells could be located in a better area to not to inhibit redevelopment of the property. I know I had a site in South Florida that was redeveloped, a large site that was separated out into parcels, and so the developer fortunately was able to design her property lines to coincide with where our monitoring wells were. But, you know, if we'd known that up front, we definitely could have put them all, you know, in the area between, you know, right on the property lines between the parcels so that it wouldn't inhibit or it wouldn't be something, you know, right in the middle of a parcel that you would have to work around. It's also possible for the prospective purchaser, like I said, to agree to do part of the remedy if you know, our timeline doesn't meet theirs. EPA implements our best remedies when we receive reuse information as early in the cleanup as possible. But it's not always possible, and especially for older sites, we benefit from reuse information at any stage because we continue to evaluate and ensure that sites meet protective standards. Any of you familiar with the Superfund process know that unless we clean a site up for unlimited use, unrestricted exposure, which most of them are not cleaned up to those levels, then we're required to do what's called a five-year review every 5 years and continue to ensure that the remedy that we put in place is protective. So we're always with these sites, with most of these sites, and so having a good use happening there really helps us protect these remedies in the long run. EPA understands that local governments often are resource-strapped and may have not a lot of experience with Superfund sites. We do this every day. We know this. We may not know a lot about other things. The other thousands of things that local governments have to deal with, but we do know Superfund, and we are here to help. We have a lot of tools. We have resources and support for local governments and community members and developers who want to get these sites back into productive use. Now, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to joke about this. When people hear the word Superfund, I see this expression on the left here many times, and I want to talk about how local governments can play a critical role in helping address these sites. You know, when people hear Superfund, it's a scary word. Most people think about Love Canal and liability risk and the worst of the worst and all this, and it's true. You know, we're there for a reason, and we're there to help get the site cleaned up, but we also have a lot of resources to help get it back into productive use. So, you know, what I want to do in this webinar and what Matt and Victor are going to do is to show you how you can go from this type of expression to this type of expression. You know, which is an enthusiastic, hey, I want to redevelop this site. You know, most Superfund sites are where they are because of the infrastructure around them. They're near the interstate. They're right in the middle of a downtown. They're near waterways. They're near power grids, all of these things that can really be useful once they're cleaned up. And so there are lots of local governments and developers who are actively seeking out ways to help us redevelop sites. Just a minute before this webinar started, I managed the Brownfield program in Region 4, and the section chief of the Brownfield program texted me a minute before 2 o'clock, and she said, I have somebody who's looking for a site to redevelop that's over 1,000 acres and preferably a Superfund site. Let's talk. And so, you know, we have people that are actively looking for this because they know the benefits of the tools that we have and how we can make these projects not only financially viable but help them manage their risk. And that's one of the key things. Yes, it's a Superfund site, and yes, there are lots of liability risks, but you won't find another property that is better characterized, and you can address the risk up front when you're looking at redeveloping the site so that it's not some kind of unknown that you have to manage in the future. So you may be asking, okay, so as a local government, what can you do? You know, how can you help with this? Well, local governments have a vested interest in the health and safety of their residents, of course. They're also interested in attracting jobs and providing affordable housing and community amenities and collecting tax revenue and many more priorities that a local government would have. So what are the and some of the important roles that local governments can play? Well, local governments can acquire the site for long-term ownership or transfer to another entity. Sometimes this is done through government redevelopment entities or land banks and things like that. They can foreclose on tax liens to get the property out of a defunct ownership situation and extinguish other liens. That's a very powerful thing that they can do to help make a piece of property more viable for a developer to take on. They can promote the financial viability of site reuse with things like tax increment financing and tax benefits like opportunity zones or enterprise zones. They can help with site access. Sometimes EPA has trouble accessing a site when the ownership is questionable or uncertain. Site assessments and investigations, and especially securing site restrictions, which we call institutional controls. It's a huge issue for EPA, and local governments are a critical partner in helping get these in place. And these are things like, well, until the groundwater is cleaned up, we need to restrict issuing a permit for putting in a drinking water well. You know, local governments are poised to help EPA with that, and we can help make it such that your residents are protected while we're conducting our remedy and work as partners. Rezoning and community planning is definitely a role for local governments to meet the anticipated future land. How can we help local governments? Well, we can help local governments by providing information, of course, by cleaning up the site. You know, that's what we're there to do. But there's also tools and resources such as reuse planning, which is you see some of these pictures here. These are from reuse planning exercises where we get the community together and talk about future use. We can provide comfort letters to developers to help them understand what their potential risks are and what the limitations of the property may be. We can help anyone, whether it's the local government or a developer or the community, understand liability protections to enable local governments to make informed decisions and help work with us to get these properties back into productive use. So we have a few tools, and we have lots of tools. So I'm going to talk about, we're going to talk about today six of these, and I'm going to talk about a few of them, and then Matt and Victor are going to talk about the ones that are more legal in nature. And of course, you can visit the Superfund Redevelopment Program's webpage, of which this is the link on the bottom of the slide here, to learn more about these tools and many other things. So let's get started with that. The first of all, and I'm particularly proud of this because I worked with a Region 4 attorney, Kat West, to do this in her office one afternoon. This was right before 2002, and we were starting to get a lot of interest in people redeveloping Superfund sites, and people, you know, EPA staff, attorneys and project managers still were uncertain about what the types of reuse, how we could work reuse into the cleanup process. And, you know, we said, look, we're getting a lot of questions, and we need to come up with a process to make sure that people are getting clear information where they can make a timely business decision on whether or not the site's right for them. And so we formed this concept or this process called the prospective purchaser inquiry process, and this is what is still used in Region 4 and in many regions across the country where we can ensure that we get quick, and this is important because every developer will tell you time is the killer of all deals. You know, you can't, think about this for months. And in Region 4, we had a goal of when we got the initial call from a prospective purchaser that we would set up one of these calls within 5 days and have it within 5 days. And we assembled the site team, so the project managers and the attorneys and the enforcement folks, to make sure that we had everyone on the phone who could answer these questions. And so we go through this call in a fairly structured manner, and we talk about these four issues that are on the slide. So we talk about what the site status and current and future site restrictions either are or may be. We talk about what we think we're going to do if it's early in the process. Well, we know there's a lot of contaminated soil in the back of the building where the wastewater pond was. We're probably going to have to excavate that. There's a contaminated groundwater, so there's going to have to be restrictions on using the groundwater, things like that. And then we turn it over to the prospective purchaser, and we ask them, well, what is your proposed reuse? And, you know, we can't guarantee compatibility. It's up to them to make sure that what they do is compatible with our remedy. But if there's anything that's an obvious incompatibility, we point that out, and we can help have a discussion about what their thoughts are. And, well, you know, this area is a cap, and, yeah, you can, you know, maybe park trucks on it, but you can't dig it up or things like that. The third issue we talk about are liability protections, and those of you that are familiar with the bona fide prospective purchaser provisions of the 2002 amendments would know this is what we talk about, how to be a bona fide prospective purchaser and what that means. And then if we have any lien, so EPA has two lien authorities under Superfund. This is the EPA Superfund lien, which is for past costs money that EPA has spent on cleanup, and that can be perfected against liable parties. And we also have the windfall lien provision, which was included in the BFPP amendments, which is something we can talk about, whether or not the windfall lien provision applies and what that means for them. Another tool that we have are fact sheets. So, and I'm particularly fond of this one, too, because about maybe a year after Kat and I worked on the prospective purchaser inquiry process, we said, you know, we're getting a lot of the same questions on these calls. And I had just seen David Letterman the night before, and I said, well, why don't we do like a top 10 questions to ask when buying a Superfund site? And so Kat liked the idea, and she pulled out her pencil, and we just started writing down questions that, you know, we were getting. And then, fortunately, Matt Sander, who will be speaking later, saw it, and he said, you know, from a headquarters perspective, this is pretty interesting. I'd like to take this and make it a national publication. And he is responsible for making it what it is today. And so this is the first link that I send people when they're interested, when I first hear that someone is interested in redeveloping a Superfund site. This is written to be understood by someone who doesn't know a lot about EPA or Superfund or what that means, and, you know, to try to provide some basic information and direct them to some more in-depth information, such as the Revitalization Handbook, which Matt authored, that goes into much deeper information about this, and the Common Elements Guidance and many other tools referenced in there. And then what they mean is kind of just discussed in the top 10 questions fact sheet. So if you're interested at all in this, you just want to see what it's all about after this webinar, take a look at that. Now, this is a good one. And this is a few years old now, and we're actually working on updating it. So within the next year, look for an update for this to come out, hopefully. So we're excited about that. So what else can we do? Well, EPA is required under Superfund to engage with the community on our remedy. And so reuse planning is a way to also engage with the community on what the future use options are. So it's a particularly useful tool for communities and local governments, especially in those situations where you have an abandoned site that's right in the middle of your town and, you know, that's uncertain what the future use is going to be. And maybe, you know, the community and the local government can have a real impact on what that is. So it helps involve community members, and it provides a forum to discuss what the needs are, what the site would support, what the local government can do, what the local community wants. And things that Superfund can't address necessarily, but we can at least have that discussion and start looking at what's going to happen after Superfund. And we have a great video called Life After Superfund that was discussed as a community that we had in Fort Valley, Georgia, that I would encourage you to go to our website and take a look at as well. And they talk about how, you know, this reuse planning, which occurred in many different meetings at this particular site, and really had a beneficial outcome there in the community. And to request this, you really just work with the EPA site team, and they can work with the redevelopment coordinators and get you that. So I'm going to go through a couple of examples here, and then we'll get on with the legal talk about this. So here's an example where a local government acquired a Superfund site through a tax foreclosure and helped get it put back into productive use. The Blackburn and Union Privileges site is located in Walpole, Massachusetts. The site was abandoned, and industrial operations had contaminated soil, sediment, and groundwater. EPA put the site on the Superfund National Parties list in 1994. The town of Walpole received a reuse planning support from EPA Superfund Redevelopment Program. And what that is this is contractor support. This isn't money that you get and you have to figure out what to do with it. These are people who show up and help you do this. So it's really beneficial. You know, helps you set up the meeting, helps you have these discussions. The town worked hard to get this redevelopment plan finished before EPA's final cleanup plan was created to allow EPA to integrate the town's anticipated use into the site cleanup plan. in 2014 in accordance with the plan. After talking with EPA and their own legal counsel, the town decided to purchase the property for future municipal use through a tax foreclosure. In 2018, a law enforcement building opened on the site, and in 2019, a senior center opened on the site. The new senior center houses the Veterans Service Office, adult education classes, and other community gatherings and recreational opportunities. Just a great example, and it received our EPA Excellence in Site Reuse Award. Here's another example of how local governments can help in the planning and rezoning part. This is a magnificent site out in Region 8, the Midvale Slag Superfund site in Midvale, Utah. This site occupied a significant portion of the town of Midvale. Five smelters processed lead and copper ore at the site, which resulted in toxic levels of heavy metals in the soil and groundwater. It was put on the National Priorities List in 1991. EPA worked with the town of Midvale, local residents, and the site owner to ensure the cleanup supported local revitalization and redevelopment goals. Midvale became the first community in EPA Region 8 selected as a Superfund redevelopment pilot project, and it led to the reuse assessment and master plan being created in 2000. So this was a while back. This plan allowed Midvale City to update its zoning ordinance and reflect the plan's mixed land uses. Midvale City also designated the site as a redevelopment project area, which enabled the use of tax increment reimbursements to help reimburse developers for site additional infrastructure costs. The collaboration on institutional controls was important for this site. EPA and Midvale City worked together to develop an institutional control process plan that included zoning and subdivision regulations, building, road, and excavation permits, and engineering design guidelines. The community also requested that EPA provide a document that the site's remedy would support the land uses outlined in the master plan. In 2008, EPA issued a ready for reuse determination for the site, which is another tool that we have. That we have at our disposal. Today, this site is home to Bingham Junction, which is a thriving mixed-use development supporting thousands of jobs. Builders have completed extensive residential development at the site, and new buildings on the site include single-family homes, townhomes, condominiums, apartments, and assisted living. EPA Region 8 recognized the city with an Excellence in Site Reuse Award for their work, and after 20-plus years of collaboration and dedication at the local, state, and federal level, this site was transformed into a vibrant community resource. The third site I'm going to give as an example was actually my site back when I was a project manager, the former Spelman Engineering site in Orlando. It was a former parts cleaning facility which had contaminated the soil and the groundwater. The City of Orlando and the Orlando Utilities Commission, which is their power and water commission, acquired the property to close the facility that eventually became part of the Superfund site, because the groundwater had extended underneath the city's property. The community was concerned that the lack of a responsible party was going to cause the site to be put on the National Priorities List, and they really didn't want that because of the stigma and the concerns. And so the city announced in 2008 that they would voluntarily clean up the site while simultaneously selling some of the land they owned, which was contiguous to the site, to a local private school for recreational use. These discussions produced three interlinked agreements, which were really complicated. There were a lot of things going on here, but the three the primary ones were the contiguous property owner agreement, which was the first of its kind we actually created for this situation, and now since we've done this, it's available to be used as a model for others like this, where the city, a contiguous non-liable adjacent property owner, agreed to voluntarily clean up the Superfund site. And a bona fide prospective purchaser agreement, which is more common. We do more of those, which was between EPA and the school to waive EPA liens and provide liability protection. We worked with them to bury our groundwater cleanup system, which was an enhanced bio system. We injected molasses into the groundwater, to put it in layman's terms, to optimize the reuse opportunities. On top of our groundwater cleanup system, the school built a baseball field. But there's also practice fields and parkings. They needed to expand their sport facilities, and so this land was perfect for them. A segment of the land also includes the Orlando Urban Trail, which is a biking trail that now extends through the area. Commercial and industrial businesses are located on part of the site, and the city is exploring opportunities for mixed-use redevelopment near the Central Florida's new SunRail commuter rail line and other public transit facilities. So there's a lot going on at this site, and the city played a key role in working with us to help get it cleaned up. So just some takeaways that I have here. EPA's ultimate goal with the Superfund program is to return sites to productive use in a protected manner. That's we have to do that, and we want to do that. The local governments play an important role in successful reuse, which can include short and long-term acquisition, tax foreclosure, zoning, financial incentives, site restriction implementation, and many more things. There are EPA Superfund redevelopment tools that are available, liability protections, resource and support available for local governments, communities, and redevelopers. And if you don't remember anything else, remember this slide. These are the redevelopment coordinators that work in the EPA Superfund program in the 10 regions. These are the keys to getting this information. Like I said, I'm on a temporary assignment to headquarters, and headquarters has always been very willing to work with the regions to provide contractor resources and funding and guidance and tools that they may need to help get these sites put back into productive use. And these are some of the most innovative and hardworking people I've ever worked with. And so, you know, if you're in one of these regions, then, you know, make sure and look back at this slide to see who the redevelopment coordinator is if you need this type of support. And if you need any have any questions of me or of the Superfund redevelopment program in headquarters, you can either call me. This is my number in Region 4, or Frank Avasado, who was unable to join us today, who works in headquarters who I'm on detail working with at this number and email. And either one of us can help you with talking about these tools or getting you in touch with the right folks. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues, Matt Sander and Victor, to talk about addressing Superfund liability concerns of local governments.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you all for joining us today. I'm really happy to be here to discuss how the federal Superfund law, which is also known as CERCLA, and how the Environmental Protection Agency can address local governments' concerns about potential Superfund liability that's associated with property acquisitions. I'm an attorney in the EPA Headquarters Office of Site Remediation Enforcement, and I've been working on brownfields and Superfund redevelopment for close to 20 years, most of those time often working closely with Bill, so it's been a real pleasure. So my office is responsible for providing EPA guidance on Superfund liability protections and site-specific tools to assist property owners and other interested parties clean up, reuse, or redevelop contaminated property. Today, I'm going to speak about the Superfund liability exemption that's only available to state and local governments, and which was recently improved by Congress in 2018. I will also go over in a bit of detail a recent EPA enforcement discretion guidance, which focuses on acquisition methods and issues not explicitly addressed by that liability exemption. My colleague, Victor Zertucci, will then speak about Superfund liability protections for bona fide prospective purchasers and the EPA's 2019 Common Elements Enforcement Discretion Guidance. Victor will also speak about EPA's site-specific enforcement revitalization tools that may be available to address the potential liability concerns of local governments who are interested in acquiring contaminated sites. So it's important to begin this discussion by taking a moment to reaffirm the EPA enforcement program's commitment to working collaboratively with stakeholders to reduce Superfund liability barriers to the protective reuse of contaminated properties. Superfund's landowner liability protections codify many of the policies and practices that the EPA enforcement program had previously implemented to facilitate the cleanup and reuse of contaminated sites. The enforcement program's reuse efforts at contaminated sites that are addressed by the federal government have focused on addressing potential liability concerns of parties who did not cause or contribute to the contamination, but we also focus on ensuring that the sites remain protective of human health and the environment. These efforts together utilize enforcement discretion policy and guidance documents and site-specific tools to facilitate reuse. The enforcement program also has a role in facilitating the cleanup and reuse of brownfield sites. Brownfield sites are generally lower risk contaminated properties that are addressed under state programs rather than under federal cleanup programs like the Superfund program. The EPA enforcement role at brownfield sites is generally limited to reviewing the eligibility of brownfield grant applications to ensure that potentially liable parties are excluded from federal grant funding. And finally, to clarify the EPA's limited role at brownfield sites addressed by state cleanup authorities and to provide greater certainty about EPA's enforcement intentions, EPA has entered into memoranda of agreements with 25 states individually regarding how we intend to exercise our enforcement programs with respect to these state cleanup programs. So pretty important documents, those memoranda of agreements. Okay. Like most parties looking at developing Superfund sites, local governments generally are known to be very cautious when it comes to acquiring contaminated properties due to concerns about becoming potentially liable for the costs or the performance of a Superfund cleanup. Under federal law, a party that acquires a Superfund site could be potentially liable as a current owner or operator of the site, regardless of whether they are at fault or negligent, or whether their conduct was in compliance with industry standards. In addition, a current owner can be held liable for the entire cost of a Superfund cleanup, even when there are multiple liable parties. At brownfield sites, local governments' concerns stem from the fact that potential liability makes them ineligible for a federal brownfield grant that could help pay for getting the site or the property cleaned up and or assessed and cleaned up. Fortunately, there are a number of federal statutory liability protections that may be available to help local governments address their liability concerns associated with acquisitions of contaminated property. These federal liability protections apply to both Superfund sites and brownfield sites. Some of these Superfund liability protections are exemptions, while others are affirmative defenses. Some of the key protections are listed here on this slide. Today we're going to focus on three of them. First is the exemption for state and local governments when they acquire contaminated property. Second is the bona fide prospective purchaser defense. And finally, we'll talk about the innocent, the third party defense and innocent landowner defenses. All right, Section 10120D of Superfund, of the Superfund law, was established in 1986, and it's a really powerful statutory protection because it exempts a unit of state or local government from the definition and thus the liability of an owner or operator when they acquire contaminated property through certain methods of acquisition. Congress recently amended this exemption in 2018 through the Brownfields Utilization, Investment, and Local Development Act, also called the BUILD Act. The BUILD Act expanded and clarified the Superfund liability exemption for state and local government acquisitions. It also removed the previous statutory requirement that the title of the property had to be acquired involuntarily. That previous word involuntarily caused a great deal of confusion. So Congress did us a great favor removing that term. Today, a state or local government is exempt from Superfund liability when it acquires contaminated property through seizure or otherwise in connection with law enforcement activity, through bankruptcy, tackle delinquency, abandonment, or through other circumstances in which the government acquires title by virtue of its function as sovereign. A really important caveat you need to be aware of is that the exemption is a really powerful exemption, but it does not apply when a state or local government has caused or contributed to the release or threatened release of a hazardous substance from the property it has acquired. So I'm going to spend some time here today talking about the development of a guidance document that the EPA issued in June of 2020. The title of it is listed here on the slide, as is the URL for it. I encourage you to read it if you're your local government and you're thinking about acquiring a contaminated site. I'd like to begin with a little bit of background on why we issued the guidance before we go into the real substance of it. Back in 2017, we began looking at local government liability concerns under the recommendation 31 and 32 of what was the Superfund Task Force. While that effort was underway, the Build Act was enacted in 2018, and we determined that an enforcement discretion guidance was really necessary to address a lot of questions that still were not addressed by the Build Act with regard to local government liability concerns. An important part of what we did is, under the Superfund Task Force, was to solicit stakeholder input. We did that a little more than a year ago at the 2019 Brownfields Conference. We followed it up with a webinar, we called it a stakeholder listening session, just about a year ago, December 2019. And we received a lot of meaningful public comments, including written comments, from following the stakeholder sessions. We also did a tremendous amount of outreach within the agency, particularly talking to our regions who, are the folks managing day-to-day with these sites and the questions that come in from developers and local governments. So we got really great input from our colleagues. And we also worked with the Department of Justice to make sure that they were supportive of where we were going with this guidance. One thing I want to just caveat here, I keep mentioning local governments, because that's the focus of this, but the liability protection also applies to state governments that are looking at acquiring sites. But we see this come up mostly in the context of local government, so that's why I'm not mentioning the states over and over. All right, so our guidance document, it was addressed to EPA regional staff so they can help work with local governments on these questions, but we wrote it understanding that state and local governments and the public would be publicly available, so they could be informed by it too, is what where EPA and get a better understanding of where EPA's enforcement intentions are regarding certain circumstances not clearly covered by the law. The guidance is also intended to assist local governments by providing just a basic overview of the Superfund liability framework and other liability protections that might come into play through the lens of acquisitions. So this slide here lists a number of acquisition methods and issues that aren't clearly addressed by the statute, even despite the 2018 amendments. So we're going to go through each of these on the following slides, and this is what the focus of our guidance document is, to try to be clear what our EPA's enforcement intentions are, even in these areas where the law isn't clear. So first, this is probably the most important slide of my presentation. This is there's a provision in Section 10120D that exempts a state or local government when it acquires by virtue of its function as a sovereign. This is a really critical term, but it's unexplained. There's no description of what does this mean. So we've done a lot of homework on it, and we're going to treat an acquisition by virtue of its function as a sovereign as an acquisition when the state or local government is exercising a uniquely governmental authority and performing a function that is unique to its status as a governmental body. So in other words, this is our enforcement discretion is only available when the acquisition is pursuant to a function that can only be effectively performed by a government using a legal mechanism only available to a government. And you'll see why we made some of those distinctions in a moment. Some common examples of by virtue of function of sovereign would include tax lien foreclosures, intergovernmental transfers, tax increment financing transactions, escheat, eminent domain for a public use, and demolition lien foreclosures. Additional examples are identified in our guidance. So this slide lists out acquisitions by purchase, inheritance, bequest, gift, or donation. The Section 10120D of the Superfund law doesn't address these questions. So what we did is to try to determine whether they would be covered by the by virtue of function as sovereign test, we applied that test and we concluded that all these acquisitions are not covered by the exemption because they're available to private parties. And therefore, they're not an exercise of a uniquely governmental authority performing a uniquely governmental function. So that means that for these acquisition methods, EPA's enforcement discretion under this guidance is not applicable. Fortunately, there are other liability protections that may be available for local governments that acquire these properties in one of these through one of these methods. These liability protections include the bona fide prospective purchaser defense, which Victor's going to talk about, and in limited circumstances, the innocent landowner defense, which I'll cover in a few minutes. Each of these defenses are also covered, discussed in our guidance document. Next, this is another one where EPA has gotten a lot of questions about this over the years, about whether Section 10120D's exemption applies to transfers between units of government. For example, when a property is transferred from a county that has acquired it to a municipality who's going to be the end user. Although the statute is not clear about this, our new guidance does address this. Under our guidance, EPA's enforcement discretion is available for certain intergovernmental transfers if a few conditions are satisfied. First, the governmental transferee must acquire by virtue of its function as sovereign, consistent with the test we discussed earlier. Second, the transferor and the transferee both must not have caused or contributed to a release or threatened lease. Release and must not have otherwise be potentially liable under CERCLA. A typical example is when a city or county acquires the title of a tax delinquent property through tax lien foreclosure and then transfers it by like a quitclaim deed to another local government entity. In addition, if a governmental transferee is unable to satisfy the by virtue of function of sovereign test, it may look to see if there are other liability protections available, like the BFPP, bona fide prospective purchaser defense. Oops, I think we skipped a slide here. A little trouble here by slides, just one on here. Keep getting back to those. Trying to get to slide 33 here. There we go. Another acquisition method not covered by, clearly covered by Section 10120D is a sheet. This is a reversion of private property to a government in the absence of legal claimants or heirs. So we looked at this, and this clearly falls within that by virtue of function of the sovereign test. And further, back in 1995, EPA looked at this and said we intend to treat this as an exempt acquisition. So we reaffirmed our 1995 policy, and we think this is acceptable practice under Section 101.20D. It's also important to know that as we go through each of these liability protections, whether you are or are not covered by the 101.20D exemption, it's a really great idea for local governments, well, any entity acquiring human sites, but local governments to think about, they can actually layer their liability protections. Their multiple liability protections can be available for the same type of acquisition. So that's just something that important to keep in the back of your mind. Okay, moving on to eminent domain. This is the power of a government to take a property from a private party and provide compensation. It can be used to acquire property for public uses and in some instances for private economic development. This authority is sometimes initiated and exercised in conjunction with other authorities to use or address contaminated property. Eminent domain is not addressed by the Section 101.20D liability exemption. Under EPA's new guidance, we intend to treat eminent domain acquisitions that are for a public purpose as falling within the by virtue of function of sovereign test and being covered by the liability exemption. We do not intend to treat eminent domain acquisitions for economic development that primarily benefits private entities as covered by the liability exemption. Our distinction here for public purpose acquisitions versus the economic development acquisitions for that benefit private entities, again, it's informed by our by virtue of function of sovereign analysis that I mentioned earlier, and it's also informed by legal concerns that have been come as a result of the Supreme Court's decision in the Kelo case a number of years ago. So our guidance identifies a number of common eminent domain acquisitions for a public purpose, including acquisitions for parks, recreation, and civic buildings in areas to serve the general public. Those are just to name a few. Although we're not taking the broad interpretation of eminent domain to extend the exemption to the acquisitions for like the economic benefits that primarily benefit individuals, liability protections may be available. So that's going to be a common theme. It's not an all or nothing here. I'd say this is my second most important slide with respect to this liability protection. The exemption from Superfund owner or operator liability is not available if a government's acts or omissions have caused or contributed to the release or a threatened release of a hazardous substance from the facility. State and local governments can avoid that kind of outcome and losing their liability exemption at properties they acquire by being diligent environmental stewards of their acquired properties. Common examples of actions or omissions that could void the liability exemption include the dispersal of contaminated soil during excavation and grading, or the failure to prevent the release of hazardous substances. To better understand EPA's approach to this requirement and to other liability protections that may be available, our 2020 guidance refers back to a detailed discussion that's in our 2019 guidance called Common Elements. That guidance discusses the no disposal requirement, and it also includes a appendix on what are called reasonable steps, which are very related to this area. So I really encourage you, if you're a local government and you're looking at this exemption, to take a look at that. Another aspect of our guidance was there were questions about what does the term unit of state or local government mean? That term is in the CERCLA 10120D liability exemption, but it wasn't clear what that meant. So to provide some additional certainty of what this means, our guidance applies a really broad definition of local government that's found in grant regulations. And so we've adopted that. And in addition, our guidance also makes it clear that we're going to treat redevelopment authorities, land banks, and community development agencies as a unit of state or local government for purposes of the Section 10120D exemption. Our guidance from last summer also includes just a summary of some of the other liability protections that might be available to local governments, the principal one being the bona fide prospective purchaser protection, which Victor is going to speak to in a few minutes. Those are listed here, and they're also briefly discussed in our guidance document. And we thought it would be helpful to include a table in our guidance document listing out sort of the top three available liability protections and breaking down by the method of acquisition. Okay. So that table lists another liability protection, which we don't get a lot of questions about, but it's not as extensively used as like the bona fide prospective purchaser protection or the Section 10120D exemption that it has covered, but I'll give you a quick overview of this. So for the third-party defense, when a local government is concerned about owner or operator liability, they might be able to assert this third-party defense if it can show by a preponderance of the evidence that the contamination was caused solely by the act or omission of a third party. To invoke this defense, the third party's acts or omission must not occur in connection with a contractual relationship between the party asserting it and the third party. An entity asserting the defense also has to show that it exercised due care with respect to the contamination and that it took precautions against the third party's foreseeable acts or omissions and the consequences that could foreseeably result from such acts or omissions. Related to the third-party defense is the innocent landowner defense. In 1986, Congress amended Superfund and expanded the third-party defense by creating an innocent landowner defense. This defense applies to entities who satisfy the third-party defense and additional criteria in Section 10135A. A local government might be able to satisfy the innocent landowner defense by either acquiring contaminated property without knowledge of the contamination after they've performed all appropriate inquiries or due diligence into the prior ownership and uses of the property, or if they acquired it by escheat, involuntary transfer or acquisition, eminent domain, or inheritance. A local government also must demonstrate that all disposal occurred prior to its acquisition, that it is in compliance with land use restrictions and does not impede institutional controls of the property, that it's taking reasonable steps to prevent the releases of hazardous substances, and that it's providing full cooperation, assistance, and access to persons authorized to conduct a cleanup. So bottom line is this innocent landowner defense is also available, but it's got more requirements, several more requirements to it than the Section 10120D defense. So I'm now going to turn the presentation over to my colleague, Victor, who's going to discuss the bona fide prospective purchaser defense, the EPA common elements guidance, and EPA's site-specific revitalization tools. All right, Victor, take it away.
Great. Thank you, Matt. All right. So like Matt said, we mentioned briefly the BFPP protection. And so if a local government can't take advantage of either the 10120D liability exemption that our guidance addresses or 10135 innocent landowner defense that Matt just talked about, we encourage that a party do the things necessary in order to become a bona fide prospective purchaser, which I'll call BFPP for short. And this concept is stated throughout our local government liability guidance. The concept of if a party is unsure if they will meet the other protections that they should achieve and maintain their BFPP status. And the requirements for the BFPP provisions are located in the Superfund Law and CERCLA at sections 107R and 10140. And on the screen here, you'll see the requirements for a BFPP, and of particular importance is, and a distinction, is that a BFPP can purchase with knowledge of contamination. So they can know that the contamination is there, and this separates it from both the contiguous property owner and the innocent landowner defense, where you are not able to avail yourself of those defenses if you know about the contamination. The BFPP provision also notes that the property can be subject to a windfall lien where the federal government has been involved in a response action. And Bill mentioned this a little bit earlier, and that lien would be the lesser of EPA's unrecovered response costs or the increase of a fair market value that's attributable to the cleanup. And so we won't discuss today, we won't go into any detail about windfall liens, but I do want to note that EPA does have a 2003 windfall lien policy, and that discusses in detail and has a model windfall lien resolution agreement to resolve a potential windfall lien with a BFPP for the payment of a sum of money. Matt also mentioned common elements guidance, and in order to meet either the three statutory liability protections, either one BFPP, two contiguous property owner, or three innocent landowner, there's a set of requirements that a party must satisfy. And a lot of these are same or similar, and so that's why the title of the document is common elements. So these are elements that each of these have in common. And these requirements can be broken down into first, threshold criteria that a party must satisfy prior to acquiring the property, and continuing obligations that a party has a continual obligation to satisfy after they acquire the property. And those requirements are here listed on the slide. The main requirements that we provided updated guidance to in the 2019 Common Elements Guidance are the first three that are under continuing obligation. Those are the demonstration that there's no disposal of has occurred after the acquisition. Second, that there's a compliance with the land use restriction and not impeding the effectiveness of land use controls. And then third, taking reasonable steps with respect to hazard assessments that are affecting the landowner's property. Although those are the most important ones that are really addressed of common elements, all of them are discussed in the 2019 guidance. So the common elements guidance itself is really the core enforcement document that deals with these three self-implementing landowner liability protections and their requirements. The initial guidance was issued in 2003, shortly after the 2002 Brownfield Amendments, which added BFPP and contiguous property owner protections and clarified innocent landowner. And the 2003 document noted that it was interim in nature, and it contemplated revisions as EPA gained more experience in implementing the Brownfield Amendments. So throughout the next 16 years, between 2003 and 2019, whenever they released the guidance, EPA gained experience on a number of ways. And so we've incorporated that experience and those lessons learned into the guidance documents, and it includes a better understanding of Brownfield's law, and include stakeholder feedback through various conferences that EPA has attended. The updated guidance in 2019 was also a product of the Superfund Task Force goal efforts, and it was recommendation 29, which contemplated revising the guidance both based on case law development and lessons learned both by EPA and the private sector. And issuing the guidance was actually part of a broader goal, which was to optimize our tools and realign those incentives to encourage third-party investment in contaminated properties. So the intended audience for this guidance is actually EPA enforcement personnel, but in practice, it provides really good and general information to third-party stakeholders who want to become involved at impacted properties. These stakeholders that may reference common elements could be landowners, developers, lenders, or investors that have potential liability concerns. So on this slide, you'll see attachment A, and the guidance lists out all the elements on this chart, which is included in the guidance. And although it's a little bit too small to see here, this chart is super handy. And as a practitioner or someone that's concerned about whether you've met each of those requirements and where each of those requirements is listed in the statute, this chart breaks it out into the statutory reference and the requirement, and whether it's a threshold obligation or something that you have to do as you continue to own the property. Let's see. For some of the requirements that were updated in common elements guidance, you'll see here appropriate care, land use restrictions, and disposal acquisition. So the guidance first revised reasonable steps requirements, and it provided clarity on the appropriate care for bona fide prospective purchasers. And EPA wanted to provide better clarity on how a party could meet reasonable steps of those obligations to better reflect congressional intent and EPA practices. This is involved updating reasonable steps in the guidance itself and also having attachment B in the guidance, which in the old guidance was a questions and answer document. And EPA aimed to update the relevant case law and revise the comfort status letter to reflect the revision to the 2019 comfort status letter policy. Secondly, land use restrictions and institutional controls were comprehensively revised in the guidance. These revisions were intended to provide better clarity on the requirements that landowners have to comply with land use restrictions and not impede the effectiveness or integrity of institutional controls. Generally, we look to incorporate language from other recently released guidance, particularly the 2012 PIME guidance, which stands for Planning, Implementing, Maintaining, and Enforcing ICs. And finally, the 2003 guidance didn't examine the requirements that the party that purchases the property after all disposal of hazardous substances have occurred at a facility, and EPA recognized the importance of providing clarity with respect to disposal after acquisition. And the statute talks in terms of all disposals occurring prior to acquisition, but in reality, this results in a continuing obligation and has to be followed during the property ownership because a party will lose their liability protection if a disposal occurs after they've acquired the property. So the updated guidance discusses examples of what EPA would warrant enforcement discretion and harmonizes the reasonable step requirement along with the no disposal after acquisition requirement. So the link to the guidance is here, and I believe it's in the materials as well, and it was released in July 2019. And again, I'll note that the intended audience is EPA enforcement personnel. However, it is a beneficial document that to be read and digested by the general public or someone that's interested in redeveloping a potentially contaminated site and wants to know more information on the liability protections that they can get for themselves. So with respect to that, marking the common elements guidance, I also want to talk about some of the site-specific redevelopment tools and revitalization tools that EPA uses that references back to the local government guidance and to common elements. And those are mainly comfort letters and agreements with non-PRPs. And those are the acronyms you see here, PPA and VFPPPAs, we'll discuss in a little bit. So first, comfort letters. Comfort letters provide information that the EPA may have about a specific property and information and the cleanup process. And they also talk about potentially applicable statutory protections that we just mentioned in common elements. And the comfort in the comfort letter comes from hearing directly from the EPA near in time to the property transaction. So as Bill mentioned earlier, we realize that real estate transactions and development usually move really quickly. And so EPA strives to work to get a comfort letter to an interested party to describe either the status or the liability protections that they can potentially apply to that recipient. EPA has been doing comfort letters since the 1990s and the 1996 policy, and the most recent update to the comfort letter policy was in 2019 pursuant to the Superfund Task Force. So in the 2019 guidance for the comfort letters, there's attachments at the end of the guidance that have model letters. And those model letters, EPA regions use to send to recipients, people who are interested in either purchasing a property or getting more information about contamination at a property, and they use these four letters. So the first is the Federal Superfund Interest Letter. That would be appropriate for a site that is actually on the MPL. So a site where there is a current federal Superfund interest. The second letter, a no current federal Superfund interest, that can be provided when EPA has concluded their work at a Superfund site, and except for possible operation and maintenance or institutional controls, that the site is no longer of EPA's interest. It could be archived or deleted from the national priority list. There's also the no previous federal Superfund interest letter. This sometimes occurs if a property is nearby a Superfund site or if someone is aware of it being close to a Superfund site. And if EPA has never taken an interest or has never conducted any Superfund work at a site, this would be the letter that they would get. And then finally, a state action letter where the state has the lead for the day-to-day actions at a site. A state action letter would be the letter that they receive. And OSRE in the office that I'm at headquarters, me and my colleague Elizabeth Freed are working on several other models that would also be attached pursuant to the 2019 guidance. And those are created to address some of the examples we've seen come up from site-specific cases. So for example, a property status letter that provides information about a site but doesn't go into a discussion of liability protections. That's just where the recipient wants to know where is it at in the cleanup process. A repower comfort letter where a party is interested in redeveloping a contaminated site for renewable energy, a repower letter would be appropriate. A local government comfort status letter. So this letter follows very closely our 2020 guidance on local government acquisition, and describes, and the intended recipient is to be a local or state government who's interested in redeveloping a property. And we also lastly have a HUD comfort status letter, which would go to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, where HUD is interested in developing residential low-income housing on a property. And we've also strived to update the language across all of our letters to make them more comforting and to make it better for a recipient and facilitate redevelopment at contaminated or potentially contaminated properties. So an example of where a comfort letter has been beneficial and facilitated redevelopment can be seen from EPA Region 5. Here, this is a site in Clarksville, Indiana. And it was formerly a mobile home park, and then it was used as an auto salvage yard. And the property owner passed away in 2017, and there were taxes on the property. So the town of Clarksville reached a settlement agreement with the property owner's widow, and in October 2018, the Clark County Auditor conveyed the property to a redevelopment commission for the town of Clarksville. The town of Clarksville, after they acquired the property, then requested assistance from EPA in cleaning up the property, and EPA and the town conducted a phase one, which detected high concentrations of arsenic, lead, and surface soil samples, stuff that was dumped at the property when it was used as an auto salvage yard. And once the town became owner through the tax delinquency, they requested that EPA clarify their potential liability with respect to the site. So in January of 2020, last year, Region 5, in consultation with our office, we issued a local government comfort status letter. And that letter did basically three things. It outlined the CERCLA liability with respect to the local government acquisition. It explained the steps that the town needed to take to maintain their BFPP status. And it stated the agency's position on a windfall lien for a property like this one. And that letter was sufficient to help the Redevelopment Commission of the town of Clarksville to assuage their concerns, address their concerns. And the town is currently working with a nonprofit to develop this formerly contaminated site and develop it into a 500-acre park that connects existing greenways along the Ohio River. So something that is relatively easy to do in the form of a comfort letter can result in measured benefits and good community benefits and redevelopment at a contaminated property. So in addition to comfort letters, there's also agreements. So agreements with non-PRPs. These typically occur at sites of federal interest and where a party has not caused or contributed to the contamination. And they can arise where either a party wants to purchase, so they acquire it, lease, or develop a site of federal interest. And so the main draws or attractions of getting an agreement is that that party gets a covenant not to sue from the EPA, and they also get contribution protection with respect to other parties who may have claims for cleanup they've conducted at the site. And usually EPA looks for this party to perform CERCLA work or pay some response costs in exchange for that covenant not to sue or contribution protection. So there are generally two types, a prospective purchaser agreement and that the PPA, which I'll refer to, that has the Section 10140 obligations built into the agreement. The purchaser is not a PRP since they are usually getting this agreement before they own the property. Well, they are getting this agreement before they own the property. And they get an existing contamination and work payment covenant not to sue in exchange for payment to the EPA. So you'll notice some of the benefits and some of the features of a PPA here on the screen. The other type of tool is a bona fide prospective purchaser agreement. And this typically occurs after a party has already acquired the property and they can say that they are a BFPP. And they get the same contribution protection and covenant not to sue. And the main distinction here is that they typically already own the property, and because of that, oversight payments can be deposited into the trust fund rather than to a site-specific special account. Here we have a chart that talks about the differences between PPAs and a BFPP agreement. So in a PPA, you don't have the statutory protection, whereas in a bona fide prospective purchaser agreement, you do have that statutory protection under 10140. And if it's a matter of when or whether they own the property, if you already own the property, you can't get a prospective purchaser agreement. You'd be limited to a bona fide prospective purchaser agreement. And again, a PPA can also take the form of a prospective lessee agreement. So if a person is leasing the property rather than purchasing the property. And more recently, kind of an oversight of what EPA has seen with regard to PPAs with respect to local governments, we've seen an increase in local governments wanting to become parties to these agreements. And typically this arises where there's still obligations to clean up the property. A private development has stalled for some reason. And this type of agreement can facilitate a multi-party settlement cleanup of claims of the property. And these agreements tend to leverage and have the unique ability of allowing local governments to achieve site-specific goals of Superfund cleanup and enforcement goals. So as a result, these types of agreements with local governments have successfully facilitated property transactions that have stalled, settlements with potentially responsible parties, and allowed for PRP settlements, and they also allow for continued protection of constructed remedies. So although they're not as common, PPAs and VFPPAs with private parties are more common than those with local governments, local government agreements still have a place for, you know, getting negotiations that are stalled or facilitating certain types of unique scenarios. So some of the things that I've mentioned here are all available on the slides and also along the right with the related URLs. And these are documents that can reference, and they talk about some of the things we've talked about today. The Revitalization Handbook has examples. Common Elements Guidance is more of a legal document, but gets into the very nitty-gritty of these protections. The Comfort Status Letter, so you can see what a comfort status looks like. Then also EPA's policy on third-party agreements. So with that, that's a quick overview of some of our site-specific tools. I will hand it over back to Bill, and hopefully we can answer some of the questions that have come in through the chat.
Great. Well, thank you, Victor. Appreciate that. That was a great summary for everyone, and we do have some questions, so let's get started with those. I guess we have about a half an hour to answer questions, so that that will be a good amount of time. So first of all, before we get started, I did want to say that the Spanish version that I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks, I had the date wrong. It's February 12th that we're shooting for, and I guess I would just encourage everyone, if you're interested, to go to the same website as this one, and on the CLUIN website there are announcements for upcoming webinars, and that will give you the registration information. The registration is not open quite yet, but thank you for putting the slide up, Gene or Josie. appreciate that. So we plan to have that on February 12th. So like I said, please let folks know if you know people who would prefer to listen to this in Spanish that that's going to be available. And as soon as we have registration information, we'll send that out as well. So, okay, let's get to the questions. Question one, is there a tab, or that's the technical assistance for brownfields, is there a tab for brownfield sites to help communities plan for redevelopment on Superfund sites? So there is. Brownfields and Superfund are different, and we had a couple questions about brownfields, and so I'm going to talk about this for just a minute. From EPA's perspective, a Superfund site is a site that we have responsibility for managing the cleanup for, and for helping the community get the site back into productive use. From the brownfields program, we have two components of that. One is we give grants to states to run their state brownfield program, and the second is we have our competitive grant process for local municipalities or nonprofits to apply for on an annual basis to apply for brownfield grants. So they're completely different in the way EPA approaches them. So there is not a tab for helping communities plan for redevelopment on Superfund sites, but at Superfund sites that we're cleaning up, and this was another question, I'm going to combine the two here, was the second question was, is contractor support for reuse planning still available? So the way contractor support for reuse planning works is the site team, which includes the RPM, the attorney, and the community involvement coordinator, would be the ones to determine when it would be appropriate to do reuse planning in consultation with their redevelopment coordinator. So if you're in a local government or in a community that is looking at doing reuse planning, I would encourage you to talk with the site team and with the Superfund redevelopment coordinator on what, because it's going to depend on, you know, where are we in the site, what type of site are we looking at. You know, for any kind of redevelopment to happen, you have to have a willing site owner, and you have to have someone to make it happen. So if the site owner doesn't want to sell or doesn't want to, you know, do something, our authority doesn't require them to do that. So it's really up to the property owner. And like I said during my discussion, for properties that are abandoned and maybe the future use of them is uncertain, that is, in my experience at least, where reuse planning can be the most beneficial. But we've also seen it been beneficial on sites where people own them, you know, and you know, of course, it's important to work with the property owner on what those future use opportunities are. So if I didn't answer that correctly, feel free to type in another question. I think we'll have time to get to more things, but that's kind of the difference between how the TAB process works and how reuse planning works. Okay, next question. Is it possible to delist, or what we would say delete from the national parties list, parts of a site that are easier to manage? Yes, we do have the ability to do what we call partial deletions, for especially this is particularly useful on larger sites where part of the site may have been cleaned up and another part is being addressed. So yes, it is possible to delete part of a site as a partial deletion. And again, that is a decision made, you know, at the site team level about, you know, how, and certainly we encourage that where it would promote redevelopment. However, it's important to know that circle of liability still exists even on a deleted site. We can still take an action on a deleted site if need be to protect human health and the environment. So our guidance, our closeout, EPA closeout guidance talks about this. So deleting it from the MPL doesn't delete there from ever being any liability concerns. And so that's why it's important to make sure that you understand what a bona fide prospective purchaser is and that you meet those requirements when you go to redevelop a property. Now, deleting a site from the national parties list does make you eligible now to enter into state brownfield programs. And so that is one reason that people will ask us to partially delete a site to promote redevelopment so that they can then get the site into the brownfields program and maybe do some additional work under that. So that's and Matt and Victor, feel free to jump in if you have anything to offer extra on any of my questions. So if there's anything from your perspective that you'd like to add on to this, please do that. Okay, next question. Can I talk more about the five-year review requirement and how reuse affects it? So EPA, like I said, where we don't clean up sites to meet the unlimited use or unrestricted exposure criteria under Superfund, or if it has been more than 5 years since we started the remedial action, those are two types. We have statutory five-year reviews and what we call policy five-year reviews. We will conduct a five-year review at the site, and that's really a time to just step back and take a look at the remedies that we've implemented and ensure that they are protective of human health and the environment and that the assumptions that we use to make that remedy are still valid. So that could be anything from assuming that you know, the cleanup standard for arsenic was such and such, and now in the last 5 years, that cleanup standard has gone down, and so now maybe it's not still protective, or it could be for TCE or any number of or emerging contaminants like PFAS that we didn't know about when we designed the remedy, or it could also be for the land use assumptions that were made. So if it, you know, were assumed that a property was going to be used for commercial industrial, and now, you know, it looks like that they're moving more towards a residential use, that would be a land use assumption that's changed. And in those situations, that's where we would need to work with the developer to make sure that the remedy document and the cleanup that occurred matches what the actual situation is at the site. And so basically, the way the five-year review and redevelopment interact is that whatever types of redevelopment occur on the site need to be consistent with what the remedy is and what the restrictions are on the property. And if not, that will be highlighted in the five-year review and have to be addressed. Okay, so this is a kind of a general question. Just to clarify, these benefits listed for Superfunds are also available for brownfield, correct? And again, you know, the difference between a Superfund site and a brownfield is distinct. And so benefits would be the same. So the benefits with redeveloping a Superfund site and the benefits of redeveloping brownfields are the same. The communities are benefited by, you know, getting the property back on the tax rolls, by getting the property cleaned up through Superfund. It's through enforcement. Through brownfields, it's through a voluntary cleanup, that where someone that wants to use the property comes in and does the cleanup. But the benefits for redeveloping contaminated property are the same. However, if you're talking about benefits like the resources, like I said, they're very different, because EPA is doing the cleanup for a Superfund site, or a responsible party is doing the cleanup and EPA is overseeing it. For a brownfield, we're giving grants to state and locals to work with people to do cleanups. So, you know, we're not as directly involved. Okay, next question. Are prospective purchaser agreements available to a lessee, and are they managed in the same way? That exceeds my knowledge of PPAs, and so I'm going to ask Matt or Victor if you are able to weigh in on this. If not, we may have to get back on this one. So are PPAs available to a lessee, and are they managed in the same way?
Yeah, this is Matt. A prospective purchaser agreement with a lessee is something we refer to as a prospective lessee agreement. And we've done a handful of them. They're not real common, but they are an option. And I'd also just like to remind you that leaseholders are also covered by the bona fide prospective purchaser liability protection. So it's not just purchasers, but leaseholders are also covered by the protection and can be a party to a prospective purchaser agreement.
Thank you, Matt. And I want to thank OSRI for their work on that, because there was a lot of question about that after the Brownfield amendments were passed as to whether or not this applied to lessees. And the folks there in OSRI really worked hard to clarify that and come out with guidance and work on the PPA documents as well. So you can thank them for having that that guidance out there and that being clarified. Okay, so another question. Would the city need to request redevelopment planning assistance? So the answer is you could, but you don't have to. So in some situations, remember now, from an EPA perspective, our project managers and community involvement coordinators are going out to the sites, going out to the communities, engaging with your local communities, and trying to figure out what the reasonably anticipated future land use is. That's, we have a guidance document called the Reuse Directive, and it talks about this concept of the reasonably anticipated future land use. In certain situations, EPA may initiate this reuse planning, like in the ones like I talked about, where you have, say, in Region 4, we have a lot of wood treaters, you know, creosote plants that made light poles and cross ties and fence posts and things like that. And sometimes those are abandoned. The owner is bankrupt. The property has a big lien against it because these are expensive to clean up, and EPA is doing this as what we call a fund lead project. So EPA is spending federal money and using our own contractors to do the cleanup. In that situation, we would definitely be working with the local government and the community to think about what the future use of that property is and what types of things the community may want, what the property would support, what the local government wants. And in that situation, EPA may initiate a reuse plan, a reuse planning exercise to try to determine that. Again, you know, like I said, in those situations where maybe the responsible party owns the piece of property, they know what they're going to do with it in the future, you know, our authority doesn't supersede what their desires are, because they're the landowner, and so they have, you know, rights as the landowner. So it really would depend on the situation as to whether or not it makes the most sense there. But if you are a local government and you think reuse planning would help at your site, it would certainly be a good idea, if it has not already occurred, to bring this up to the site team and to the redevelopment coordinator and say, look, you know, we think it at this site, that reuse planning would be beneficial, and here's why. So the answer is kind of it depends. Okay, I think we're now into questions that are more legal in nature. So Matt, I'm going to read these and then ask you or Victor to weigh in on answering those. So the first one, if eminent domain is for the mixed benefit of nonprofit and private, would it qualify? Now, I'm not sure what they mean qualify, like whether it would meet the liability protections or not. But if it's, the question reads, if eminent domain is for the mixed benefit of nonprofit and private, would it qualify?
So I think it, I'm guessing it's, the question is asking, would it qualify for the liability protection or and coverage under EPA's guidance where we are talking about eminent domain? I mean, without knowing more, I would just off the cuff say probably not, because it looks like, you know, our guidance is really focused on a public purpose. But even if it weren't able to qualify for protection, or if it was a really close call, there are other liability protections available that I would encourage in any event a party in the, like the circumstance like this to pursue the bona fide prospective purchaser defense. That's a really, really powerful, tested, and you know, frequently used liability protection that many parties and practitioners are familiar with. So I really encourage you to look. Probably that's probably a better place to look.
Okay. All right. We've got a couple of complicated questions here. So let me look and see if there's some easier ones before. I guess we have time to do these. Here's a good one. Is there a cost to get a comfort or status letter? That's an easy one to answer.
No, that's an easy one. No, there's not.
No, there's not. There's not a cost. We don't charge for those. We don't require there to be any compensation or I'm struggling for the word here, but that we sometimes use for prospective purchaser agreements and all consideration. If you're interested in a piece of property, as a developer and you're or a local government and you want a comfort letter, we can have that discussion and get a comfort letter out to you. Can we request a local government comfort letter for a brownfield site, or does the site have to be a Superfund site to qualify? Ooh, that's a good question. I would say, well, I don't know, Matt or Victor, what would you guys say about that?
I don't. It definitely doesn't have to be a Superfund site, but the only issue that we would run into there, because there is status letters, which provide basic updates for where it is in the cleanup status, but the status letter generally just says that EPA hasn't taken a federal interest in the property. So we could issue it, but there's the question of whether how much information EPA would have, especially if it's state lead. So if it's a state action letter, it just may refer back to the state. But it can, we can provide just a general status letter.
Yeah, thank you, Victor. And I guess I thought about something here too, Matt, and then I'll turn it over to you. And of course, I'm the non-attorney talking here, so you can take this advice for whatever it's worth. But the issue is too, if you're purchasing and redeveloping a brownfield, you're going to have liability protection under the enforcement bar. So, that's going to be something that is going to be very useful as far as managing liability, managing risk.
Thanks. Just one point I wanted to add too is, even if it is just a brownfield site, it might be helpful if you're having a difficult time finding information about any information about the site. It might, in some cases, it might be critical just to get a letter from EPA where the lender can take to the lender and say, look, here's what EPA knows about this site. If saying we know nothing about the site is also, important. Sometimes it's a negative, but if it's a brownfield site, then, you know, it can just be a confirmation that EPA is not engaged at the site or focused on the site.
Right. Thanks, Matt. Yeah, and I think the only thing I would say is that, you know, as I said in my presentation, the just by virtue of the number of brownfield sites that are out there, you know, it's very likely that we wouldn't have a lot of information about the site. So would EPA ever undertake reuse planning directly with community organizations and not involve the local government? I would say I'm not sure exactly what this question is getting at. I think, you know, reuse planning is where we engage with the stakeholders on a piece of property. So, you know, we would not, we always work, or at least every site I ever worked on, we worked with local governments to inform them. Some, you know, had more of an interest in being involved than others, but, you know, we would never specifically exclude the local government, but if they, for whatever reason, were not interested or able to participate, that doesn't mean that we would not do the reuse planning. So if that's what your question's getting at, it's certainly better if the local government's involved in the cleanup, not just in redevelopment, but in the cleanup and future of the site. Okay, I'm not sure we're able to answer this yet, but the question is, what type of consideration do we expect for a BFPP? I'm not sure exactly what the question's getting at there. As a BFPP, there are specific criteria you have to meet. Some of them you have to meet prior to taking ownership of the property. Some of them you have to maintain after owning the property. So there's no, you know, it's a self-implementing defense to liability. So you can come in and purchase a site and never talk to us and, you know, attain or assert that you're a BFPP, and that's perfectly fine. That's how Congress set it up. You know, our processes and all these tools are intended to help provide the information you know, on things like reasonable steps and due care and things like that. I'm not sure, you know, we don't require, you know, payment or anything other than complying with the criteria that outline what a BFPP is for consideration. Some of those are, you know, complying with existing restrictions. You know, so if there's a restriction on using the groundwater because it's contaminated and you put in a well and move contamination and we have to take an action, that's going to, you know, affect your defense to liability as a BFPP, things like that. Matt,
Bill,
anything you want to add to that? Or?
Yeah, I think, you know, with the question of what kind of consideration would you need if you wanted a BFPP agreement, in that instance, we're looking for more than just the obligations of satisfying the BFPP defense. For an agreement, the agency is looking for some kind of consideration, ideally in the form of work, doing some of the work as part of the remedy. It can be payment, it can be in-kind services. There's, you know, we've seen the gamut of consideration, but something that's like a simple enhancement isn't going to suffice. It's got to be something that the program needs to happen at the site.
Right.
We
Thank
often,
you, Matt.
We often see sometimes it's you know, it can be some kind of you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, we've seen the value of it fluctuate too from millions of dollars, like you know, we've seen off-site work out in rivers get some kind of assessment work done that the agency otherwise would have had to pay for. We've seen smaller amounts of consideration where it's taken into account, has it facilitated another enforcement settlement with the property owner, and, you know, sort of getting to the greater good. So it really is a site-specific kind of question. Victor, did you have anything you wanted to add? I'm sort of jumping into your part of the presentation here.
No, I would just say, you know, like to reemphasize above and beyond what the BFPP obligations are, and that there is a general preference for work, and that it is such a site-specific inquiry, and it varies. It varies, and there's a lot of factors that go into, you know, the adequacy of consideration, especially for BFPPs when there's a preference for prospective purchaser agreements.
Yeah, and I'll add one last point. These agreements have to be approved by the U.S. Department of Justice, and that's one of the first questions they always ask us is about the consideration. What is the United States getting in exchange for providing a covenant not to sue to the purchaser? Because we approach these agreements as if a party's already a bona fide prospective purchaser, they've got a self-implementing liability protection, and this agreement is just adding to that in exchange for a covenant not to sue, which, you know, these agreements, they're important, but they're not always necessary, they, you know, do take time to negotiate.
Good point. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Victor. Those are great points, and I think you're right. I think that's what the question was getting at when we get into consideration. Okay, so now we've got a couple of complicated questions in our last few minutes here. We'll try to tackle these. So one of these is, often a site will sit undeveloped because prospective developers don't want the liability. If a local unit of government takes the property in some fashion with the intent of cleaning it up and transferring the site to the developer, perhaps as a TIF project, will the city incur any liability since the end user is private and it is primarily an economic benefit to the city as opposed to a park or municipal use?
Ooh, that's a multi-pronged question there.
Yeah.
I'll start with just the liability with respect to while the city owns the property. You know, we went through various ways to acquire liability protections. If, you know, the city does not become an owner or operator and incur that liability, become liable as an owner or operator under CERCLA, they could just maintain their liability protection and then transfer the property to a third party. That protection is not going to extend to the third party. So even if the third party were to put in some kind of public use service, that third party, my advice to them would be make sure they've got their own independent liability protection. There's not once the property is transferred, any protections that the local government have wouldn't automatically confer. Now, the local government could consider indemnifying that transferee. You know, if the property is safe, there's no outstanding PRPs at the site, then sure, your risks, the risks of potential liability go way down, but it's really going to depend on the facts of the case.
And Matt, I guess that if the city took the property with the intent of cleaning it up, then that would be under some kind of agreement, right? That would be under a PPA or BFPP doing work type agreement. So those things would be discussed in the negotiation of that agreement, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So that's the, you know, if the city, and that's, I think, part of the question asked, if the city or local unit of government takes the property in some fashion with the intent of cleaning it up and then transferring it to a developer, then the city would address its liability for conducting that cleanup as part of the BFPP doing work agreement. And I just want to make sure that people aren't confusing this with brownfields, because this is completely different. We're talking about Superfund sites here. So if it's a Superfund site, then it's, you know, on the national priorities list, then EPA is either going to conduct enforcement action to make the cleanup happen or use federal funds to do the cleanup action. If it's a brownfield, then you're trying to attract development to do that, and that even though it's both under CERCLA, it's different, right?
Yep.
Right. So that's just it would be different in those two situations. Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to read this other question, and I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do this. This might make more sense to you, Matt and Victor. And not that it doesn't make sense. It just exceeds my knowledge of legal issues. So does liability protection apply if the transferee is a municipality that acquired an abandoned property via purchase, conducted lead-based and ACM survey, and then transferred the property to a local redevelopment unit created by law? So this person says, I'm working with a TBA application, and the applicant, as a redevelopment unit, is interested in completing a phase one, to address potential concerns associated with ACMs. I'm not sure what ACMs are.
I think the liability protection in this case might, first for the initial local government that acquired it by purchase, you know, that's going to be the bona fide prospective purchaser protection, because purchases aren't covered by the Section 10120D protection. If they then transferred it to a local redevelopment entity that's a, you know, part of a unit of, it's part of a unit of government, or actually it doesn't have, yes, I'll just stop there. If they transferred it, that unit of government get theirs, the transferee could benefit in the sense that our new guidance makes it clear that transfers between units of government, if the transferor is a bona fide prospective purchaser, the transferee can be protected as a BFPP without doing an all-appropriate inquiry, so long as they meet the other BFPP requirements. So we're letting the transfer the all-appropriate inquiry step, essentially, as part of their getting that protection. I'm not probably not saying this very clearly. Did I answer that?
Yeah, I think that was a good attempt at getting at what the question was. So we have one more question that's come in. I think we have a couple minutes to answer this. And the question is, what kind of support is available for reuse planning? Legal, schematics, financial? So the answer is, the way reuse planning works is it's when our consultant, EPA's consultant, comes to the community and establishes a group of stakeholders. You know, this could be representatives from the community, representatives from local government, and works on trying to figure out what types of use is desired and what type of use the site would support. And, you know, sometimes, you know, a lot of times people want parks and stuff like that. Sometimes local governments say, look, we have a lot of parks. We don't, you know, we can't afford to keep up another park because parks don't generate income for cities. You know, the property doesn't anyway. Having parks generates income because people like to live next to parks, and so that it increases property value. And I'm certainly a proponent of parks. But, you know, the local governments have to balance these types of issues about, well, how much green space do we have? What's the highest and best use for this property? What's best for the community? The community would say, well, this is what we think's best. And so what reuse planning does is help have those conversations and have people understand what the realistic and have realistic expectations of what the future use of that property could be based on, you know, a lot of things, you know, based on, you know, what's around the area, you know, or do you have enough grocery stores, do you have enough health clinics, things like that. You know, then there's a plan. Now, that's the extent that EPA can do, is to help the community plan for what that future is. We can help direct you to other ways of getting money to make that happen, you know, whether it's through HUD or through Department of Interior, or whether it's through, you know, different organizations that that offer assistance for especially environmental justice areas and places like that to help rebuild. And we can help identify those, but that's, you know, that's really the extent. So you have schematics, you have a plan, you have a, you know, this is the site, this is the size of the site, this is, you know, these are the areas that the cleanup is going to impact, this is the, you know, way that the cleanup is going to occur. And so really it gives everyone an opportunity to have a say in what that could be and try to, you know, come up with a combined vision of what the site could be in the future. So we also have guidance for reuse planning. So if you go to our Superfund redevelopment website, then you can see that. So I think we're out of time. So I'm going to turn it over to back to Gene. Those are some great questions. Thank you all for submitting those, and thanks for hanging there in with us. We had one come in at the very end, but I don't think we have time for it. So we're going to go ahead and wrap it up now. So Gene, if you'll take it over.
All right. Thank you so very much, Bill. I appreciate that. I want to walk through just a few quick final reminders for the audience, just so that everybody is comfortable with some key pieces of information before we close things out today. So the first reminder that I wanted to point out to everybody is that they are certainly welcome to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network or cluin.org or sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of the month and will advertise free online sessions like today's. So I do encourage you to sign up for those newsletters. For those of you who are interested or looking for copies of the presentation content, we have already posted those materials on the seminar homepage. We talked about it a little bit at the start of today's session. It was the area when you were checking in. There's all sorts of tabs on that page with information about our speakers, and there are links to also download the presentation materials as well as browse a number of the resources that have been collected and highlighted in the presentation today. So if you're looking for copies, we've already posted that. I've made that available on the middle right under related URLs. You can scroll through those links and actually click on them to open them. You can also use the links that I've been pasting into the questions box to access that material as well. Contact information for presenters and organizers is also available on that seminar homepage. And I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. Remember, we are trying a new version of Adobe Connect, so some of you may have experienced a few new features today. If you did have any difficulties, let us know. That very brief online feedback form will give you a chance to comment both on the content that we covered along with the tool that we used to host today's session. And I do read each and every one of those sessions as well as the organizers for these events. Those oftentimes participating in our sessions will email me and ask if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While I don't issue those types of credit hours for our sessions, we can provide you with a webinar certificate for joining us. And that's what you'll get if you fill out that online feedback form. So if you would like a certificate, please be sure to fill out that online feedback form and make sure you check the box at the very bottom of that feedback form to certify you were here for the entire session or you replayed the entire archive. As long as you check that box and then submit your feedback form, you should immediately have access to a certificate that looks something like this one on the screen that you can download or print out for your own records. If you happen to have a number of people joining at your location, each person can actually fill that feedback form out on their own, even if they didn't register individually. So if you did have others sitting with you, I encourage you to share the link to the feedback form with those individuals so they can send in their own thoughts and get their own certificates. And then there were a number of you who were asking if the session is going to be recorded or made available for on-demand playback, and the answer is yes. We usually get these things posted in about 1 week. Everyone who registered in today's session will automatically get an email as soon as that recorded version is available for on-demand playback. So I encourage you to keep your eyes peeled for that. As Bill mentioned, we'll also point you to the registration information for the February 12th session. We'll be offering it in two languages, both English and Spanish, so I encourage you to keep your eyes peeled out for that message as well. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have before we close things out, but I did want to echo my thanks to all of our presenters who shared their expertise, along with the over 300 people who connected for today's session from across the U.S. today. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll join us on a future delivery. And with that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.